Blog Talk Radio.
Listening to Q Talk Radio. Q Talk Radio is an LGBT talk radio station. We're also the creators of the LGBT Hero Awards. I'm your host, Xavier Mejia. Today is July 21st and the time is 12 p.m. Thank you for joining us today. Today's episode is 1 out of 6. Our guest is Marta Segura. Marta Segura is the CEO of her own public affairs firm, Gold, a change agent, strategist, coalition builder, nonprofit consultant, and board member of the Southern California Leadership Network, the Los Angeles League of Conservation Voters. Help me welcome Marta Segura. I know I'm saying your last name wrong, Marta. How are you?
Good. How are you, Xavier? Great to be here with you today. And you're pronouncing it correctly. It is Segura, so your pronunciation is great. No worries.
Oh, okay. Good. Well, thank you for, accepting my invitation to come on our show to talk about, this heavy discussion. And one of the things I've prefaced, to our audience earlier on leading up to today is that, we're going to be talking about something that a lot of Latino families don't speak about very openly. And I have a feeling that many families don't speak about this openly. And that's, the topic of incarceration, the topic of the jail system and how it's affected Latino families. And this term, I think we're going to be using this term a lot, this pipeline from, the school to prison pipeline. So I thank you for accepting my invitation to speak with me. I reached out to you because I read your article and, you speak about this very specific issue. So thank you for accepting my invitation.
Yeah, and I just wanted to say that the thing that started this, I've been looking at it for a long time, but La Comadres is a network of mothers interested in education, and the network asked me to write for their blog, and I just wanted to do a shout-out for them, because even though I can't say, I'm going to say up front, I'm not an expert on this issue, but I am a social justice advocate, and this is one of the major issues I think that is affecting our community, our community's ability to prosper, and our education. So it's definitely an issue that hits close to home in almost every Latino family. I think every Latino family has somebody who's gone to jail or prison, youth camps, or all of the above, and we feel guilty about it, and we feel like it's dishonorable. And I think that that's exactly why we need to put it out in the open and talk about what the policy issues are that have created this environment in our communities and have disproportionately put our kids and our youth and predominantly our male youth into youth camps, although it's also our young women who are being put into these youth camps and prison pipelines. So thank
Correct.
You again for having me here. And I also wanted to say real quick that and we'll talk about it more later, it's not unrelated to immigration detention centers, because the same prison industrial complex that pays for the development of new private prisons is also paying for the development of immigration, private immigration detention centers. And the bottom line is, we're not even counting those numbers in this article where I said one out of every six males ends up in, or Latino males ends up in prison. That's not even counting the number of males and family members that end up in those immigration detention centers. So that number would be a lot larger if we counted that.
Right. Well, thank you for saying all of that. I want to share with folks that Marta has more than 20 years of management, leadership, and advocacy experience in public and nonprofit sectors, and has served as district director for the then council member Eric Garcetti and now mayor of Los Angeles. So that said, can you share with our listeners a little bit about who you are? Where did you grow up? Who were your influences, and how did you get to, you know, have your own public affairs firm?
Well, that's a pretty long story, but I'll try to make it short. I was born and raised in San Jose, California, and I think that my influencers were my teachers. Back then, it was right after the civil rights movement, so there were teachers in my school that were part of the Chicano movement and were very upfront, like only 1% of you will end up in college. More than 50% of you will not graduate from high school. You can't be one of those statistics. And so when I heard that when my freshman year in high school from my teacher, Mr. Montenegro, who ended up being a superintendent in another school district, I'm like, what? This is, you know, that totally that politicized me. And then I realized that there were other teachers like him around me, and I gravitated towards those teachers because they were there to really help us and support us, and they understood our neighborhoods, they understood our environment and where we were coming from. So I have to give those teachers from both my elementary school and high school a lot of credit. And I also have to do a shout out for the Upward Bound program, because the Upward Bound program existed back then. It still does today, but I think back then it was revolutionary to put a kid from high school in a college environment at a very young age, in spite of their bad grades, in spite of, you know, the environment that they came from and how difficult things were. So I think that's how I got started, you know, that's what politicized me and made me very aware that our kids were being tracked in high school, even then, to the lowest level classes, and none of them were in the, like, quote-unquote AP classes. And it was really, anyway, that's kind of where my influences started. But then I went to UC Santa Barbara for my bachelor's degree and got even more politicized then, because I, you know, not only took courses in biology, because I was, I didn't really know what I wanted to do, but I knew that I loved science, I loved nature, and I understood the effects of malathion and other toxics on our health. So I thought that science would be a good field for me. But I took Chicano Studies, too, and Chicano Studies further made me aware of the disproportionate, you know, impact of the policies that are created on our communities, on communities of color. And then from there, I moved on to a master's degree in public health because I continued with, like, my desire, my passion to protect people from toxics in our community. And public health seemed like a good master's degree program for that. So I think I'll stop there, because then I'll go into our history of where we are now. So I don't know if that sort of answers your questions about how I'm here today, but in a way, I call myself an accidental advocate, because I didn't realize back then that I would be doing what I'm doing today. And in many ways, a lot of what I'm doing kind of just happened because I am an advocate, and I did speak out, and I became an organizer. And when I was an organizer for Communities for a Better Environment, for example, is when I met Ana Guerrero, who is now the mayor's chief of staff. And she was the chief of staff for then Councilmember Garcetti when he was council member. So she remembered me, and she realized that the council member at that time needed to really engage the community in the way that we engaged people in Southeast Los Angeles. And so she hired me as the district director, and that's what got me into government work. And it was really revealing to me how important it was for our communities to understand how we can access government, what government is supposed to do for us, and how key it was so that we can change things in our community for us to be civically engaged and share our voices with those in power that are willing to help. So anyway, I think I'll stop there, Javier. Xavier.
So Martha, I know that you received your master's in public health at UCLA. Go Bruins, right?
yes, definitely.
So that said, is that what led you to LA? I mean, 20 years is, a good amount of experience. So, hence why we're talking about many, many facets of your life. But how long have you been in LA for?
I've been in LA since 1988. So yeah, UCLA is what brought me to Los Angeles because I felt that it was important for me to get the master's degree, and UCLA's program seemed to be the best. But once I was here, I realized that there was a lot of work to do here, and there were a lot of opportunities for advocates like us, and that this was a good place for me to stay. I fell in love with Los Angeles, its environment, its politics, its culture, and yeah, that's what drew me here, and that's what kept me here. But definitely, I love the fact that I'm a Bruin, and now I live in South LA, so go figure that, right? Because I'm closer to USC than I am to UCLA. That's
Right.
a much more expensive neighborhood. Yeah.
So let's start talking about, sort of some of the phrases, or let's help, folks understand the difference between, a youth camp and a prison. And, again, we speak a lot about the school pipeline to the pipeline. So can you share with folks, what do we say, what does it mean when we're talking about a pipeline?
When we're talking about the school to prison pipeline, we're talking about how in our communities of color, the schools there, especially in the past decade and before, were more likely to suspend our kids, or even get our kids arrested or their parents arrested for missing school. I remember getting a letter when my son was in public school when he missed more than 5 days in the trimester. It basically, I don't remember what code it was, but it basically said, look, you're the responsible guardian for your son, and if he misses school, you too will be I can't remember the exact wording, but basically I would be cited, and I could be sent to court to ensure that my son was back in school. So basically, if he missed too much school, I would be arrested and I could end up in jail. So basically, we were having punitive solutions to issues that were of a social and economic nature. So if a parent was homeless or if a child was homeless and they missed too many days in school, both of them could end up in jail or expelled or suspended. And those numbers were and are still much higher in our communities, but the realization has finally entered our legislative system that it's a disproportionate amount that's affecting our kids. So local laws have now been put into place that have made the schools aware that they need to find alternative solutions. But the school to prison pipeline came as a result of crime bills in the 90s, and really even before that, but when President Clinton was elected, he vowed to be tough on crime. So he passed the crime bill, and a provision of that was the three strikes. And then after he was successful in passing the three strikes at the federal level, states like California passed it at the state level, and then we implemented them at the local level, which affected how we treated our kids and our schools and their environments. And so a lot of kids ended up becoming having too many misdemeanors or having too many violations, and they were instead put on a path to youth camps, which leads them to a path to prison, because that's the training that they're receiving, right? They're not receiving training to go to college. They're receiving training to go to jail and to go to prison because they're being treated like criminals even when they're in school.
So what is a youth camp?
When you're underage, when you're under 18 years old, and it's not a very serious crime, those are supposed to be rehabilitation centers for our youth. But but they're far from that, right? And unfortunately, many of our youth then end up there, and they're not anywhere near Los Angeles. They're like in Santa Clarita or Palmdale or in rural areas away from the city. So they're sort of out of sight and out of mind. But unfortunately, that's where our young men who are in high school and young women who are in high school who have violated the law in the eyes of the law or the eyes of the school, that's where they end up.
You know, I actually visited a local, well, it's known as a juvenile hall here, Los Padrinos Juvenile Hall, that's in Downey. I went through a fellowship program with Public Allies, and part of our work was to go to Los Padrinos and help with, you know, some young people there. And I was reading a little bit about Los Padrinos, and it says it opened in 1957 as the second oldest juvenile detention facility in LA County, and that children are housed there while awaiting court action or transfer to another probation facility, such as a juvenile camp, a placement, or a commitment of the youth. What is it here? It's the commitment at the California Youth Authority. And, you know, in having you do research for this particular episode, you know, I was focusing a lot about, you know, the 18 and over demographic and, you know, my age range and year, you know, but when I came back to this specific demographic, you know, mm-hmm. I have to say the conversation completely turned for me. And I was reminded of seeing these young folks and, you know, my husband working at a school, I've visited his school on many occasions. And I said, you know, it's really interesting. I've actually seen young people this size in a camp. And he said, what do you mean? And I speak about it. And I've talked to other people about, and they can't relate. They can't even imagine. It's almost as though I'm creating a fantastic world and they have no clue. So how can we share with folks what this looks like and what the problem really what entails the whole process, you know, because I think oftentimes we're thinking about the system as something that's only, you know, happening to 18-year-olds or 30-year-olds or 40-year-olds. But when we're talking about this pipeline, we're specifically including this demographic. How do we start the conversation at home that this exists, that this is, you know, that this is part of the problem?
Right. I think that you're absolutely right. We don't really talk about it as a mass incarceration problem of our youth. We may experience it in our families and think that we're alone and think that there, you know, our son or our daughter is alone in that experience. But I think where I start is at the root of the problem, which are the policies that were created that perpetuated this kind of mass incarceration. And that's why I went back to the Tough on Crime bill through the 90s, because it really helped elected officials get reelected, right? And it was something that sounded great on their campaigns. We're going to be tough on crime. We're going to make your community safer. We're going to make sure your kids are safer and your families are safer. Well, you know, we talk about voting against your own interests. We too, you know, Latinos also voted for the Democrats and the Republicans, perhaps, that promised to be tough on crime because we wanted our families and our kids to be safer. But unfortunately, what it ended up doing was funding the development of prisons, the development of jails, the development of youth camps, of detention centers. And once those were built, they had to be filled because the developers and the companies that created them wanted to then be subcontractors to government and get paid for everybody, every single person that was put in that prison or in that jail. So it's a real self-fulfilling prophecy. Once you say, I'm going to be tough on crime, you say, well, I need to build a prison. Once you want to build a prison, then you have to fill it. And then you fill it with the most vulnerable individuals in our communities, right? The ones mm-hmm. that don't have lawyers, the ones that don't have the ability to defend themselves, and the parents who have the resources to do so. So, and I think that that's where I start, because then you can see why it's not just affecting your child or just affecting your daughter. It's affecting thousands. It's actually affecting 2.5 million people in the United States. And in the 80s, we only had 300,000 people in prison in the United States. So you can see how much more the prison industrial complex has grown from the 1980s to the present. And I think that the best way to understand that is to maybe go visit one. You know, go visit a facility. Like you said, there was one in something in Downey, but there's plenty in Palmdale. And the probation officers at LA County and then the probation commissioners at LA County can also facilitate, you know, a visit like the one you had with Public Allies to visit those mm-hmm. camps.
I was reading that a 2007 study by the Advancement Project and the Power U Center for Social Change says that every 100 students that were suspended, 15 were Black, 7.9 were American Indian, and 6.8 were Latino, and only 4.8 were white. The same study reports that the U.S. spends about $70 billion annually on incarceration and probation mm-hmm. and parole. So it also says that this number lends itself to 127% funding increase for incarceration since, you know, this period of 1987 to 2007. So that's a 21% increase and in a 20-year span, right?
Right, and that's nationwide. And then, of course, if you look at a western state or southwestern state like California, you're going to see that the numbers for Latinos are even higher. The numbers for incarceration for Latinos are even higher. For example, I have here that the Federal Bureau of Justice for 2012 has Latino men incarcerated at a rate 40% higher than whites, and that they're four times more as likely than whites to end up in prison. So, and then in Los Angeles and now in Alhambra, specifically, 75% of those who are arrested for, you know, having marijuana in their possession are Latino, and they don't make up 75% of the population in Alhambra, right? So there's just a disproportionate amount of Latinos and African Americans that are being arrested and then imprisoned for these nonviolent crimes. And the irony is that now we are legalizing marijuana in many states, and there's lobbyists to legalize marijuana, for example, in California. And the businesses that are being opened are largely owned by white men, but they figured out a legal way to sell marijuana in which they would not get incarcerated, right? And so it's very ironic to me that you're going to have these guys making millions, if not billions of dollars, selling large amounts of a product that was being sold by our communities, you know, in the 80s and 90s and even in this decade, and those guys ended up in prison, right, instead of being called entrepreneurs. And I'm not saying that they should, but I'm saying that there's a real distinct treatment of how we view an individual who opens up a business with a storefront selling a product that's exactly the same product, and then an individual who's poor, who comes from a poor community, and so they're going to do it street vendor style, and they're going to end up in camps or in prison for doing that.
So I think, you know, some of the commentary I've read is sort of, oh, well, you know, you do the crime, you pay the time, you do the time, correction. So as easy as that sounds, what does that really mean? What is the ongoing impact of having served time? What is this? How does this really affect our community in the long run? Because we're talking about low crime, right? We're not speaking about we're particularly speaking about the pipeline. We're talking about marijuana charges. I know you and I privately spoke about the idea of Latinos and Blacks whose licenses had, you know, created obstacles, driver's licenses, and have led them to, you know, serve time for unpaid tickets. And I spoke to you a little bit about my personal experience and having lived some of this myself at an earlier age, 20 years ago. So, but I'd like to get to this place of where we can talk about, you know, what is the long-term effect of having, you know, having to be the person, the person having to go through the system.
And I know I've also been reading a lot on this, and there was an article that I read recently, and I'm sorry, I can't remember who wrote it, but the title was "It's Expensive to Be Poor," right? Because if you get a parking ticket and it's $1, and you can't afford it, then you're just gonna put it aside and put it aside. Eventually, it could become, you know, $1,500 parking ticket by the time you make it to court. And unfortunately, that's enough for them to take away your license and take away your car. That's one example, right? But they've done studies that say that this is a widespread problem in Latino and African American communities. So if you remove a car from a family that uses it to go to work, that uses it to take their kids to school, well, just think about it. They lose their job. Their kids have to then walk to school or take the bus to school or miss school. So it perpetuates poverty in our communities to have to be the brunt of all of these tough on crime bills that are really not meant for nonviolent crime. They really should have been for only violent criminals. So I think that we're just now in California coming to the realization that this is the case, that this disproportionate impact of these tough on crime legislations at the local level, state level, and federal level have really perpetuated the poverty, that it has made it expensive for everybody, not just for poor people in California. So we've come up with Prop 47 that was passed a couple of years ago. And just this year, it was calculated that $37 million was saved because Prop 47 was meant to reduce misdemeanors to penalties from low-level crimes. And therefore, since we were able to reduce them to misdemeanors, a lot of the prisoners were released that didn't have violent crime associated with them. And therefore, we didn't have to pay the prisons, the state government and the federal government didn't have to pay the prisons for those persons being in prison. So there was a saving as of this year of $37 million, and that money is going to these anti-recidivism programs, which means we want to invest that money so that these low-level criminals don't go back to prison, but they're educated, they're trained, they're supported with social services that will keep them out of prison and, more importantly, give them their lives back, give them, you know, an opportunity to really thrive. So that's what the goal is. And but we've really just started that. Really just started that experiment, and hopefully it will continue.
And I think, you know, part of the issue that this also creates is this idea that if I'm made to serve time for a nonviolent activity, low crime, how do you then have confidence in our system? How do you then see, police officers as your to-go person for safety? You know, I think that there's also this undertone of, I have to stay under the radar, have to maintain under the radar for my safety, so that what is the crime? The crime is that you're poor, because mm-hmm. The example that you gave is that, you know, your license gets taken away, your car gets taken away, and somehow you still have to provide either for yourself or for yourself and your family. And that doesn't mean that the amount that you owe has gone away. You know, so you still have the issue that you have to meet some way. It doesn't go away. It's not. It doesn't just disappear. So how do you advance when you have this barrier and you're having to maintain an, under the radar? And I also think that part of the discussion that I'm fascinated by is that we don't talk about it enough. You know, I've had many friends, you know, that are now in executive positions, who are in political positions, who are in positions with a little bit more economic power. And, you know, in our private discussions, we'll say, oh, well, when I was younger, this happened. Oh, I've had this experience. You know, I'm a bit prejudiced about law enforcement because of this. Growing up, I was harassed and, you know, he used to say I look like a cholo or this and that, you know, but I don't really hear people speaking about it publicly, you know. And, and what I find interesting is that we have the Black Lives Matter, you know, campaign, and it's so important, and it's an important message. And I was hoping that that would also bring to the table our discussion that we need to have with our own people, you know, hey, this is an issue that hasn't gone away. And if anything, if it doesn't go away, it's going to be our kids who are going to be filling up the new jail, you know? So this is why I think it's important to have this discussion. I know we'll continue to talk about it, but what are your thoughts about all of that?
Well, I definitely feel that, you know, it is a bigger discussion, and I do think we can be grateful to Black Lives Matter because they have really brought the issue of the, you know, school-to-prison pipeline to bear, and police arresting more kids of color, Latinos and African Americans, has been an issue that they've also raised, which has made it easier for us to raise this issue and for us to get some media attention and us to get articles written in the newspaper about, you know, the disproportionate impact of those policies on Latinos, because really we live in the same community. So we live under the same laws and under the same police enforcement and under the same guise of, you know, school to prison pipeline. So I have a number here that says Black and Latino students are twice as likely not to graduate from high school. 50% of the children in the foster care system are Black, involved in school arrests or referred to as Black or Latino. This is from an infographic created by the Community Coalition, and I kind of want to give them a shout out too, because they have been working on Prop 47 to make sure that $37 million goes back to anti-recidivism, or making sure it goes back to the communities. But they've also been working on creating the awareness and these infographics to ensure that members of our community, both in the Latino community and the African American community, know how massively it's impacting our community in every way. Like I said earlier, it really perpetuates, you know, poverty. It really perpetuates lack of education, because if you're a foster care student and your parent, one of your parents is in prison and one of your parents is detained, and you don't have a real guardian to look over you, you are 70% more likely to end up in state prison. So, in fact, 70% of foster care, emancipated foster care youth end up in prison. That's a really stark number. And it's unfortunate, because what that means is this mass incarceration that has created fatherless and motherless children has perpetuated those children themselves ending up in prison, those children themselves not having economic viability or a future. So, you know, when you talk about police brutality and police engagement in this, I think, yes, they have a responsibility to ensure that they get, you know, that these larger policies have really forced them to put more of our kids in prison, but they don't see it that way. What unfortunately, most police don't see the bigger picture. What they see is the day-to-day violence. So we have to ensure that police can see the bigger picture, especially our Latino and African-American police that want to make a difference, that want to be doing good, that want to, you know, make our community safer. I think that we have an opportunity to share with them the root of all of these issues and to make sure that they have more compassion and they understand that Prop 47 and other legislation like it that ensures that nonviolent criminals don't go to prison is really important. And it's not something that has been established to make them less important, but actually more important in our communities. But we want them to be peacekeepers. We want them to be liaisons and ambassadors of peace instead of just like these individuals who come with a lot of adrenaline and fear into our communities that have youth that have autism, that have ADHD, that have other mental health issues. Because if you bring in fear and you bring in adrenaline into a situation where there's already a lot of fear because of a multiplicity of issues, that's just going to create the result that we've been getting, right? Which is, you know, death by the shooting of an officer or some other result that is negative towards that community.
Is it coincidental that the youth camps, these youth centers, are in places where we don't really get to see them? Do you think that's coincidental? I mean, I'm not trying to get into a conspiracy theory, but part of what I'm thinking is that if we don't see it, if we don't see what that looks like, if it's not in our backyard, how do we know what we're dealing with, and how do we know what it looks like, and therefore how do we grasp the concept?
Yeah, of course, I don't have the evidence to prove, but I don't think it's coincidental. And also, when you think about where these youth camps are, they're in more like rural, conservative areas that have individuals that are voting for the bonds that will build those prisons in their communities because they want the jobs as prison guards or as the administrators of those prisons, because these prisons and youth camps are pushed as economic development strategies in communities that have no jobs, right? So if you take a prison to a rural area where there are no jobs, they're going to say, heck yeah, we want a prison because that means I'm going to get a job that pays me from $50,000 to $100,000 a year and all of my, you know, community. So it cuts both ways, right? People want it in those communities. It keeps them out of our communities because we don't want the visibility of the impact of those policies being seen inside of our communities. And then, unfortunately, it's pushed as an economic development tool, which it shouldn't be. It should be a rehabilitation tool, a rehabilitation strategy that educates our kids and brings them back to health and wellness and mental health so that they can be happy and thriving in society and in their communities.
You speak on an important point, because I think there's this misconception that the school to prison pipeline really only affects the student or the youth or the person going through it, and potentially even their family, but and that it sort of it happens over there, and it happens in that home, and it happens in that complex. But really, the effect of it affects our whole society. So I think that, you know, speaking about mental health, speaking about poverty, I think that's important to include, because that seems much more tangible, much more reachable. I mean, we can all be at that place, but somehow, you know, we criminalize students when we're saying, oh, well, you know, they have so many absences. Or I actually was around a teacher one day who happened to say, oh, well, that one student, that's it. You have to watch out for that one. That one stole so-and-so's pencil. And I said, excuse me, can you say that again? And the word that this particular teacher was saying was stole. And I said, oh, really? Like, in first grade, we're already, you know, we're already calling that kid. It's a pencil, you know, we're talking about a pencil. And if we look at it from a very black and white perspective, then we'll use the word steal, right? he sold that pencil. But, and I realized this, so, well, what is the lesson here, and how do you teach a first grader the bigger consequences? How do you help them develop language to advocate for themselves? And I'm speaking for both students, the student that now had the pencil missing, and now the student that really just wanted the pencil, right? You know, how do you teach that one student and say, oh, you know, I really like that pencil and I was really drawn to it and I wanted to just have it for myself? You know, how do you teach a lexicon to a first grader that helps them understand their own thought process to help foster good mental health and emotional intelligence and impulse control? Because those are really, that's really what we're trying to solve, right? We're trying to make sure that we're healthy, productive members of society. But what does that really mean? And that means taking the time to be able to teach a first grader how to speak about the desire of the pencil, and for the other student, the fact that they didn't like that their pencil was taken, and what does that mean, and how do you communicate to the other person or your teacher or neighbor, you know, I want my pencil back and this is what happened, versus coming in and be the teacher that says, oh, guess what, you're going to the office because you took that student's pencil. And then so that word stole as a first grader really brought up that awareness for me, like, okay, how do we reframe that incident, you know, so that it's productive and it really is has a long-term effect, you know, teaching the language, mm-hmm. teaching the behavior pattern, teaching, you know, again, the emotional intelligence and the impact, I'm sorry, and impulse control, you know? And that's really, right. I think, that the homework here. So one of the things that, you know, if you don't have students in the classroom, how are you going to teach a student, you know, how to, you know, so putting them in a camp, what does that really do? What is that really perpetuating?
Yeah. Well, you brought up a lot of issues right there, but I think what I expected as a mother for my son at school was character development. And when I had him at the school that will go unnamed, I got one of those teachers when my son was in kindergarten. My son was one of the only Latino kids in that class, if not the only Latino kid. There were a few more African American kids, but mostly it was white. And it was a public school, and I thought it was going to be a great school because it was in a charter, but it was a magnet, right? And so the kindergarten teacher, even though she was Latina herself, was constantly blaming my son for in a punitive way, instead of looking at the bigger picture, that my son was the youngest kid in the class, that my son's emotional development wasn't as high as the other kids because they were older than him. You know, so he drew a dog that was blue instead of brown, she said, your kid isn't normal. He's drawing a blue dog instead of a brown dog, and that's not in par with where his development should be. And she was always writing him up negatively. And I bring that up as an example because I ultimately had to take him out of that, not just that classroom, but that entire school, because she created a record for him in his file that was going to follow him in that school and then maybe forward. And I was just like, this is crazy. I don't know how to deal with this whole system right now, so I am just going to remove my son from the school, but I had the power to remove him from that school. But your point is really well taken. We need to have character development in the schools, and we need to have teachers, especially for the younger years, that teach emotional, social development and really understand how important that is for the rest of their lives. It's not just the academics or the ABCs or learning how to read. In fact, it's even more important that they have social, emotional development at that age. And if they're being accused of stealing at a 5 or 6, they are then labeling themselves from that point forward as thieves. And that framing creates and perpetuates the problem that we're discussing here today. So I think that it's why people are asking for reform in the educational system. It's why people are asking for teachers that do more than academics. It's really all of those issues combined into one, because our youth are our most valuable resource for our future. And I don't have the answer to that, but I do think that that's why my article is an educational blog, because all the moms that write for this blog really care about the social, emotional, and academic development of youth. And we know we deserve more than what we're getting. More than 50% of our kids should be graduating from high school. More than 2% of our kids should be going to college. And if the system that we have now isn't doing that, and instead it's sending them pipeline towards prison, then the whole system needs to be redrawn and redrafted. And I'm glad that that's why we're having this conversation. It's making me a little bit emotional, so I'm going to stop for you to, you know.
I fully understand. It is a heavy topic, and I think that's probably why we don't talk about it as much in our families. I know that, like I said, having had an experience myself with the system 20 years ago, similarly for unpaid, well, it was one ticket that – one citation that had three tickets, and I was 19 years old. At the time, I would take the bus to school, so it wasn't even because I was driving a car. I was driving a little moped. I didn't understand that the full, legal system at the time, and particularly my own rights. I didn't feel like I needed to, because I thought I was just a good person, and I would just, walk through life being a good person, making good choices, and mm-hmm. So when I was confronted with having to deal with the citation, I was one of those college students that was like, oh, I'll just put that aside, I'll put it away. I don't drive, so it's not like I'm gonna get pulled over. And at some point, I did drive, and at some point, it did catch up to me, and I had to suffer the consequences. But the reason I bring that up is because, during the time that I was serving for these tickets, I didn't want my family to come see me, come visit me. I was like just embarrassed about the whole experience. I was a soft-spoken, early 20s person. People would ask me, hey, can you speak up? I can't make out what you're saying. So, I really lacked a lot of confidence at that time in my life, and particularly mm-hmm. Around mm-hmm. issues like this. I didn't grow up particularly seeing somebody in my family experience this. So it was it was an eye-opening moment. And when I came to meet so many people who were there for the exact same reason, and I realized there's a big issue here. This is a bigger problem. And it really changed the course of my life. It's one of the reasons I became an activist and agent of social change. And so it's one of those things that, even though it happened 20 years ago, my family and I have probably only talked about it once. And it was probably early on. So I know from experience, I know that we don't talk about this. What can we do to get the discussion going? How do we get the ball rolling? How do we get this topic, in our living rooms, at our dining tables? How do we start this conversation?
I honestly think that our kids are the key, because if our kids can hear this and understand that, listen, this is a much bigger issue. This is about the policies that were created that have been detrimental to our communities. And they can then in turn have that conversation with their parents to let them know, look, this is not an issue of shame on our family or an issue of shame on me. It's an issue of shame on our law enforcement policies, on our law enforcement itself, and they have to change in order to accommodate the fact that we have been completely targeted and misrepresented and mass incarcerated. So I think that it's going to be a lot easier to have those conversations with our youth, to bring up those conversations with their parents. And mm-hmm. and quite frankly, I'll bring up Community Coalition again, because they're having these conversations in their community center with parents there, and they're politicizing parents and kids about this issue. And then La Comadre, it's a great blog and your radio station. If we can, I think it's kind of like this domino effect, because Community Coalition wrote that article, then I wrote my article, then you picked up my article, then mm-hmm. this is promoting other people listening to this conversation. If those of you listening can hear me, please have this conversation in your families, because somebody in your family, whether it's a primo, a tía, a tío, or somebody, has been in prison, has been in jail. I'm almost 100% sure that all of us have had that experience in our Latino communities. I know I have, and not just one, but several people. And for the same reason, drug possession, right? Nonviolent crime. And having to do time for, you know, 10, 20 years in a prison for things that they should have just gone to, you know, to rehabilitation for. So it's, and I have had this conversation with my family, and it's actually been very healing, because they probably thought that we were judging the family member that went to prison, but we're not here to judge. We're here to educate. We're here to ensure that we understand our rights. And I guess I just ask everybody out there to continue to lift up this conversation when you're talking about education, lift up this conversation when we're talking about homelessness or other social justice issues, because this is one of the main reasons we have remained poor, we have perpetuated poverty, we have remained without opportunities, that we have foster care children, that we have so much violence in our communities. We have this violence in our communities in South LA right now, right? There's been a lot of killings, a lot of murders, and you know, people are out there asking for unity. Well, I'm sorry, we cannot just ask for unity and have a solution. We have to actually address these issues that we're talking about today. How do we reduce the amount of kids in our community that are in a foster care system? How do we ensure that more of our kids graduate from high school? How do we make sure that their fathers aren't in prison and their mothers aren't imprisoned? Or, you know, those are the things that we as a community, but more importantly, our government has to address. And let me just say something else that I said in my article. Our leaders, our elected officials need to talk about this too. So we need to turn to our leaders and ask them to bring it up in their talking points when they're addressing community, when they're addressing the media. Because I looked at who the authors of Prop 47 were, and they weren't Latino. And it amazes me that we have so many of our kids being affected, yet the authors of that were not Latino, and I wonder why. You know, why is it that our Latino elected officials aren't openly talking about this as an issue that they need to revolutionize and transform to ensure that we get it right, that we're not perpetuating more of our kids being in prison or in detention centers, because we're breaking up families either way, right? If we pick up an immigrant who's working because he's an undocumented immigrant, put him in a detention center, we're creating fatherless children who will likely end up in foster care at some point, who will then likely end up in prison, even if they are American citizens, right? So because the children are often American citizens of those that are picked up for detention centers, and we're breaking up families, and for what? To make a few people at the very top, who are the developers of these private detention centers and prisons, wealthy, where it makes our communities poor. So there's a real dichotomy there. And I think if we can get angry enough and passionate enough about the issue and understand the core reason behind it, then we can mobilize our community to also get involved. We need to be supportive of Black Lives Matter. And in doing so, we need to lift our voices about those that are affected in our community and say, you know what, we not only support you and we empathize with you and we sympathize with you, but we also want to lift our voices to make sure that everybody knows that this is affecting our community just as much. And therefore, our elected officials need to get involved as well. And our elected officials need to make this transformation with you.
Thank you for saying all of that. I think that you hit it right on the head there, that, you know, if our political climate is only about the one individual issue and not really addressing this particular issue, the issue of incarceration, the pipeline that we were talking about earlier, that if we don't do that, then all those other solutions are just Band-Aids, and that really this here has to be talked about, this issue of people of color and mass incarceration. So I hope that we can continue the discussion. That I guess I shouldn't say that we can. Let's continue this discussion. It's important. Martha, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. You spoke about earlier, lacomadre.org is the place where we can find your article, Latino Youth, Mass Incarceration, and Education. And please follow Martha on Twitter at Segura for Change. Thank you once again for joining us, Martha. I want to leave our audience with some information. I saw that Latino LA, latinola.com, has an event coming up tomorrow, Friday, July 22nd at 10 a.m., from 10 a.m. to noon, and it's Latino Fathers and Substance Abuse, Effects and Solutions. So, you know, it sounds like, you know, there are other angles that people are trying to use to solve some of the issue here. Next time, let's get Latino LA to join us in the discussion. And, you know, I hope that you're available to join us again.
Great. Thank you so much, Xavier. I really appreciate it and all that you do for our community and for the LGBTQ community as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Martha. Likewise. I hope you have a wonderful day and we'll connect soon.
Ditto. Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Cute Talk Radio. Cute Talk Radio is an LGBTQ talk radio station. We're also the creators of the LGBT Hero Awards. For more information on this episode and past episodes, please visit cutetalkradio.com. I've been your host, Xavier Mejia. Please have a good day.